Plant on the line. This is thecommentary.ca. Joining me now is Dan Gardner. He is a senior writer at the Ottawa Citizen. He's won multiple prizes as a writer and journalist, and was a senior policy advisor in the Ontario government to the Premier and the Minister of Education in the mid-1990s. His new book, his first, is called Risk, The Science and Politics of Fear. It is a tremendously interesting book about how we react to fear, why we react so, and what goes on in our brains as to how we assess risk in the world and in our lives. We are the safest, healthiest people in history, yet we are increasingly fearful. The book is published by McClelland & Stewart and retails for $34.99. His website is dangardner.ca. Please welcome to the Plant on the Line program, Dan Gardner. Good morning, Mr. Gardner.
Hello.
Thanks for joining us. How did you come to write about fear? I read your column in the Citizen Online. And, you know, I'm familiar with some of your previous work, did it extend from that?
Yeah, I think so. As a journalist, I found a pattern was occurring. When I would delve into particular issues, particular concerns that people had about terrorism, cancer, crime, whatever it was, almost invariably I would discover that the situation wasn't as bad as it was portrayed in the media, and it wasn't as bad as it was popularly believed. And at the same time, I would be coming across information that showed that, you know, there were extraordinary improvements going on, extremely positive news, my favorite example being the spectacular declines in child mortality rates, which are continuing to occur, both here and particularly in the developing world. And this good news isn't in the media. And so when I started to put these things side by side, it started to dawn on me that, you know, this is extraordinary. Here we are. You mentioned earlier, we're the healthiest and safest people who ever lived. That sounds almost trite to say it, but we have to appreciate how profound that fact is. Literally in the entire history of our species, we are the longest lived, the healthiest, the safest people. To give you an indication of how radically the world has changed for us now, I'll just use one statistic. At the beginning of the 20th century, so just 100 years ago, in the United States, which was then, as it is now, one of the richest countries in the world, the child mortality rate was almost 1 in 5. So almost 1 in 5 children would die before the age of 5. That's absolutely breathtaking when you consider that, of course, today it's the child mortality rate in the United States and the rest of the developing world is, of course, much less than 1%. So there's been spectacular improvements, and yet people are wringing their hands about things that I think, frankly, any sort of objective analysis of the evidence would suggest they should not be wringing their hands about. And the book is an attempt to explain that paradox.
You work in the media, so don't you think that perhaps, well, you know something about the media, that perhaps these if you talk about child predators on the loose or you know, perverts in the park or something harming children, that probably sells a lot more newspapers, it gets a lot more attention on television than perhaps, you know, the good news that you're talking about.
Sure, I'm sure it does.
So what role, then, does the media play in all of this?
Oh, the media is essential, there's no question. Also one of the most popular parts of my book because everyone likes a good media bash. I say that there are basically three factors at work and they're all influencing each other. The first factor is the media. The second factor is the long list of individuals and organizations who profit by the promotion of fear. And the third factor and the most fundamental is human psychology. And they're all influencing each other. To go to the media, it's usually the complaint against the media is, you know, it's no news to anybody that the media sensationalized, that the media love bad news, that the media loves scary stories. But the question is, why did they do this? And the usual answer is, as you suggested, you know, that, well, they want to increase audience share, they want to sell more newspapers, they want to make money. And while I don't deny that that can be a factor in certain circumstances, I think the better answer is much more profound than that. And the answer lies in the fact that journalists, editors, producers are human. And it's human psychology that's at work. It's human psychology that's driving the media behavior. If you look at the factors which attract an audience to those scary, frightening, tragic stories, those are the very factors which actually attract the journalists and the editors and the producers to the very same stories. Evolutionary psychologists like to say that basically humans are hardwired to tell and listen to stories. We are natural storytellers for good evolutionary reasons. And what's in a story? Well, if you examine what you know, what's a good story? If you went into a newsroom and you asked people, why did you emphasize this story and why did you omit this other information? They'll usually say something like, "Well, it's a good story," and then you know, only when you dig deeper, when you say, "Well, what makes a good story?" Well, what you will hear is you'll hear basically the same thing that you would hear from a movie producer who tells you what a good story is, or a novelist, or you know, an academic who studies Shakespeare or the Bible, because the contents of a good story are essentially universal. It's about individual human beings, first of all. It's emotional. There are strong emotions involved. There's novelty. It's different. It's unusual. That gets your attention. There's drama. There's conflict. These are universal facts of all stories, whether you're talking about you know, fiction or nonfiction or the evening news.
And
the point is that reporters are responding to that information. They're responding to the desire, the natural human instinct to tell the interesting, the tragic, the different story. The problem is, and this is where we get into trouble as reporters, the problem is that we have no corresponding natural inclination for numbers. The natural inclination of human beings, the natural state of human beings is innumeracy. Numbers don't emotionally move us. They don't attract us. We have no intuitive feeling for numbers. And the problem is the media, in following their human nature and going to the tragic story, they're not stopping and rationally asking themselves, well, hang on a second, I've got to also examine the numbers. Because what happens is the media, if you constantly follow the, you know, you're going to the unusual story, the dramatic story, what you'll end up doing is you'll create a portrait of reality which is not actually correct. The best example is crime. By far the most commonly reported crime in the news is murder. The next most common would be very serious violent crime, then lesser violent crime, and then nonviolent crime is virtually unreported. Well, that's exactly the opposite of the distribution of crime in reality. In fact, almost all crime is nonviolent crime, then it's less serious violent crime, and murder is a very, very thin strand on top. So the media, by following their human nature and telling the scary, the tragic, the unusual story, they end up creating a collective portrait of reality which is not only false, it's actually upside down.
There's a part in the book where you talk about statistics. And how does that this term that you use, denominator-driven, mm-hmm. What does that mean?
Well, if I say to you that something, I mean, there are many ways in which we misinterpret statistics, and when I say we, I'm particularly emphasizing journalists. But you know, if I say that denominator blindness means basically, if I say to you, for example, you know, West Nile virus has killed 37 people in Canada, and by the way, that's not a correct figure, I'm just making this up.
Right.
But if I say West Nile virus has killed 37 people in Canada, what should you do? Your first rational response should be, wait, it's 37 out of how many people? You know, how many people are there in Canada? There are 33 million, so it's 37 divided by 33 million. And that's when you realize, holy cow, that number really isn't so big. But if you tell it as a tragic story, and you simply say, 33 people have been killed by this terrible thing, and you don't provide that subsequent information, 33 out of how many, you can end up with, you know, an emotional, jarring, and scary story that in many ways shouldn't be as emotional and jarring and scary as it is.
So it seems like, I'm thinking this past weekend to the death of Tim Russert, and we see that there's an outpouring of emotion about one person, yet I'm sure a greater number of people died in those floods in Iowa.
Oh, yeah, and I mean, this goes to, well, Joseph Stalin was, in addition to being an evil dictator, he was also a very very insightful man. He understood human psychology, and he said, the death of one man is a tragedy, the death of a million is a statistic. That's absolutely true. As I said earlier, you know, we respond to stories about individual people, but numbers contain no emotional content, which is why the death of a Tim Russert, who we're all familiar with, and also he was unusually young to die, and it was also very sudden, which is why that can move us in a way that the report of, you know, 1,000 dead in a mudslide in Guatemala.
I hate to dwell on Tim Russert for a sec, but Larry King last night, and there were, I'm sure, other programs elsewhere, were talking about heart disease. Do you think that when the media focuses attention on diseases like that, like are we at risk for heart disease, well, the people that perhaps look like Tim Russert or that have the same sort of jobs as him, that certainly affects the audience, doesn't it? And do you think those fears are perhaps rational?
Well, you know, this is a really unusual case because the case of heart disease, I would suggest, it's actually a good thing if we do focus more attention on heart disease because heart disease is the number one or number two leading killer in the developed world. The interesting thing about the way the media handled these cases, and you're right, if one famous person dies at a tragically young age and it's a surprise, a shock, we will zero in on whatever the cause is. But it's typically not, you know, so-and-so has died of heart disease, it will be so-and-so, you know, died in a plane crash or something like that, and then we'll discuss that. And you're right, that excessive exposure to that extremely unusual event, and it is an extremely unusual event typically, results in people getting the notion that, you know, hey, this is a greater threat than it actually is. But you know, the strange thing about heart disease, as I'd emphasize, is normally if a person dies of heart disease, they're not on the front page of the newspaper, right? If a person is killed by a terrorist, that's front page news. If a person dies of heart disease, that's not in the news, which is why one of the most consistent findings of risk perception researchers is dramatic, violent, emotional causes of death, such as, you know, murder, terrorism, fire, that sort of thing. People overestimate the toll taken by those risks, and they underestimate things, you know, like heart disease, asthma, diabetes, that are undramatic and unreported in the media.
One of the interesting things in the book that you discuss is our psychology, the brain, and how our brains work. Has the brain developed much from the Stone Age to today?
Yeah. The most important thing to remember is that we are indeed animals, and we are subject to, we are the products of evolutionary pressure, the same as all the other animals. The human species has been around 200,000, 250,000 years. The genus Homo has been around about 2 million years, and of course then there was, we were species preceding those even. And it was in all that vast long time in which the brain evolved. The world that we live in today is radically transformed. People have to understand this, the most important thing. It was only 180 years ago that the first photograph was taken. In 180 years, in biological terms, might as well be 3 seconds ago. And so we're living in this radically transformed world. Not only is it physically transformed, but in particular, our information technology is absolutely radical. You know, we're in opposite ends of the country here, and we're having a nice little conversation as if we were in the same room. We think that that's normal. Well, it's not it from a historical perspective. And the important thing is to understand that the brain evolved not in the environment that we live in. It evolved in an environment which was completely unlike this environment. It evolved in an environment where, throughout almost all of our history, we lived as hunter-gatherers in bands of maybe 20 or 30 people. And it was in that environment, you know, those evolutionary pressures shaped how we perceive things and how we make judgments. Now, to go to the nature of psychology, cognitive psychologists say basically we don't have one mind. We tend to think that we have one mind. It's the conscious mind. It's the mind that's having this conversation now. And it tends to think that it's alone and it's in charge. It's not. It's not correct. There's also an unconscious mind. And the unconscious mind is constantly at work. The unconscious mind actually does a lot of the heavy lifting of the brain. And the way the two minds work, they're constantly working together. We are not aware of it, but they are. They're constantly working together. And the way they work is that the unconscious mind, its great quality, its great ability is its speed. It can deliver snap judgments. And it communicates those judgments in the form of intuitions, hunches, emotions that sense that something is true, but if somebody asks you why you think it's true, you're not quite sure, you can't quite say. That's a product of the unconscious mind. And as I say, the unconscious mind delivers those judgments instantaneously. And then the conscious mind can, of course, at any time step in and correct or overrule those judgments if it chooses. Now, how does the unconscious mind do what it does? Because, of course, the conscious mind is slow, it's lumbering, it can't make snap judgments. It has to, you know, reviewing the evidence and looking at numbers takes a lot of time and effort. But the unconscious mind, the way it works is that it doesn't survey all the information available to it and doesn't apply logic. It doesn't do all these other things that the conscious mind would do in trying to make a decision. What it does instead is it deploys what psychologists call heuristics, which are basically very simple rules of thumb, which allow it to use bits and pieces of information in very simple and efficient ways. So, for example, there's a rule called the availability heuristic, which is a very forgettable term. So in the book, I call it the example rule. The example rule is very simple. It simply says the brain will seek to use its memory as a way of forming a judgment. It will say, if I'm thinking about a risk, if the subject of a risk is brought up, it will try to think of an example of that hazard occurring. And if it can think of an example easily, then that thing must be common, therefore it must be likely to happen again in future. If it has to struggle to think of an example, that thing must be uncommon, therefore it must be unlikely to happen again in future. Now, if you think about that rule of thumb, it made great sense in that environment in which our brains evolved. If you're living in a band of hunter-gatherers, the only information available to you is your own personal experience or the experience of your fellow band members. And if you find it extremely easy to remember a time when a lion lunged out of that long grass over there and dragged off one of your band members, then there's a real good chance that you should worry about a lion lunging out of the grass over there. The problem is today we live in an environment where we are absolutely saturated in information. It's not just our own personal experience or the experience of our neighbors and friends. It's the experience of all 6.5 billion people on planet Earth. You sit down and you turn on the evening news and you see, for example, a case I mentioned in the book, a little boy in Germany is lured by a pedophile. There are images from closed-circuit cameras. He's lured to his death. He is murdered by the pedophile. Well, when you ask yourself as a parent with young children, I'm a parent with young children, and like all parents with young children, I ask myself this question, can I let my kids go out to the park and play unsupervised? Well, you're going to find it very, very easy. What's going to happen is you're going to say, well, what about strangers in the bushes? What about the threat of strangers in the bushes? And then what's going to happen? You're going to try to think of an example of strangers in the bushes snatching young children. Is it going to be easy for you to come up with an example? Well, if you saw that story on the evening news the previous night, yeah, it's going to be really, really easy for you to come up with an example because that's an emotional, tragic story. It's unforgettable. Well, your conscious mind understands that the tragic death of one child in Germany tells you absolutely nothing about the safety of your children here in Canada. But that's not how your unconscious mind is going to process the information. It's going to say, I came up with an example really easily. It was an emotional, powerful example. I'm going to run that through the example rule. It came up easily, therefore it must be common, therefore it must be likely to happen again in the future. And then you'll have that uneasy sense that, yeah, you know, there really is a serious threat, you know, of the stranger in the bushes. I better not let my children play unsupervised. And this is why we're seeing, I think this is primarily why we're seeing all across the Western world, a really extraordinary shift in parenting styles where, you know, since time immemorial, young children have played unsupervised part of growing up. But today, increasingly, they're not allowed to. They're not allowed to leave the house and play unsupervised. Parents put their children in cars and drive them to school because they're afraid that if they walk to school, they'll be snatched by pedophiles. Interestingly, the average American child is 26 times more likely to die in a car crash than to be abducted by a stranger. So that shows you how maladaptive that response is. But I think what's going on is that people are responding. They're basically using a Stone Age brain in the information age, and they're coming up with a response which is just flat out irrational.
So after studying this, after writing this book, have your fears changed at all?
The fears, no, and this is the really important point. Unfortunately, there's no off switch to the unconscious mind. The conscious mind doesn't control the unconscious mind. I cannot say to my unconscious mind, look, I've done the research on abduction by strangers. I know for a fact that it is fantastically rare. I know that there are more important things to worry about, so shut up and stop bothering me. Instead, what happens is you just have that uneasy feeling. And I tell you, even after doing all this research, I still have that uneasy feeling that this is a serious threat to my kids. But what I have to do at that point, and what I try to do, is I try to say, look, I've got to be rational about this. For example, childhood obesity is a serious risk to children. Childhood diabetes is a serious, serious risk. They need that exercise. They need to play unsupervised. That's good for them. And so I have to say, when I think about this problem rationally, I conclude that, you know what, playing unsupervised is good for them. And the threat of stranger abduction is far too small to worry about. So I'm going to try and overrule my feelings, and I'm going to go with what my rationality tells me. But still, the feelings are there. They won't go away.
So is how we manage fear, is that just perhaps a more Western phenomenon than anything else? I mean, how do other people in the world react to fear, or is it much the same?
That's a really, really interesting question, and unfortunately, I can't answer in any sort of, empirically meaningful way. Most of the research that's been done on risk perception has been Western-orientated. It's certainly been done in the developed world. There's been a little tiny bit of work done in the developing world, but, not much beyond that. The one really interesting little bit of information I would note is this, though. I was actually surprised. My book has been sold. I expected it to be sort of, a Western European, North American phenomenon. We'd be interested in it. In fact, it has sold all throughout East Asia. Vietnam, Korea, Japan, China, they're apparently interested in the subject, which suggests something.
Does it suggest that they're similar to us, or they're just interested in us?
Well, I can't answer that question conclusively, but I was really quite surprised to discover that, when I said the theme of, we're safer than ever, but we're also feeling some of these irrational fears, well, apparently, publishers in these countries think that that resonates with their people.
And how has the reaction been within this country about this book? Have you enjoyed going on tour for this?
Oh, sure. Well, actually, one of the most interesting aspects has been having these discussions in interviews in different countries and then comparing and contrasting. Because there are differences, and people respond differently to different bits of information. But what's struck me more is the commonalities. For example, we discussed stranger abduction. That is one that seems to be absolutely universal. Parents are worried about young kids being snatched by strangers. And this transformation from an environment in which, children were told, after breakfast, okay, out you go out the door and go play and we'll see you at dinner, to a world in which, children are never allowed to be unsupervised, I'm hearing that in every interview in every country. It's been really quite interesting.
What are you working on another book now, or are you just focusing on the columns in the Citizen?
Just my daily journalism at this point.
And you have no plans to write another book, or?
I do have some stray thoughts. What's really struck me about the research from this book is when I was in university, I studied many things in university. One of the things I did not study was psychology, because I had the idea that psychology meant Sigmund Freud, and Sigmund Freud was pseudoscience. Well, I think I was right about Sigmund Freud, but I was wrong about psychology. And now that I've, done some work in cognitive and social psychology, I find it to be an absolutely fascinating field, and its applicability to all sorts of different issues is phenomenal. And I'm interested in actually applying it in places where it hasn't been applied, or at least not to the extent that I think it should be, hasn't been applied before. and for instance, I'm actually toying with the idea of psychology, you know, applying basic concepts of psychology to politics. You know, I'll give you an example. I wrote a column about this. Hillary Clinton was pilloried when she described an incident in which she said she, in 1995, she went to Bosnia and she was under sniper fire.
Right.
And, of course, it was not true, and it was demonstrably not true. Well, of course, it was just taken as a given by everybody from commentators to politicians to the public that she was consciously lying. Well, if you know anything about the research on how memory works, it is just as plausible to suggest that, in fact, her memory had manufactured that memory, that, in fact, her memory of the event had mutated into that different and far more dramatic form. That's nothing uncontroversial. If you say this to a psychologist, that's not controversial. But because psychology is not often applied in the field of politics, it is controversial when applied there.
Dan, we could talk forever about this. This is just a fascinating book, and I do urge people to pick it up because, I found it thought-provoking and often astonishing. Congratulations on it, Dan, and thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
The book is called Risk, The Science and Politics of Fear, $34.99 from McClelland and Stewart. DanGardner.ca is his website, and his columns, you can get those at the Ottawa Citizen. You can get them online like I do.